Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Remember when we forgot to be depressed and started to celebrate the economic recovery? U.S. companies were rolling in profits. The stock market suggested things were great. Well, that didn't last long now, did it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday. It is the second day of June. T-bills. Got a mortgage? You're loving them. Got a money market account? Not so much. But demand for safe haven treasury bonds is so strong this week that investors are snapping them up at less than 3% interest. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports on the broader effects of the T-bond trend.
There's a saying that if you have a big hammer to swing, everything starts to look like a nail. The Federal Reserve has a lot of nails to pound down. It's trying to fix the unemployment problem, goose the housing market, and make sure you're not paying too much at the pump. The Fed is trying to attack all these nails with the same hammer, low interest rates. Here's Jeff Lehman. He's the chief investment officer of BDK Financial. He says the Fed hoped low interest rates would spur banks to lend and companies to hire more workers.
Federal Reserve's intent has been to keep rates low because that's one of the ways that you can prompt more activity in the economy.
We all know it didn't quite work out that way. The outlook for the recovery is getting worse.
Treasury's reflecting some underlying conditions in the economy.
That's Greg McGreevy, the president of Hartford Investment Management. The lower interest rates are good for the government. Its borrowing costs are falling just as people are worried about the deficit. And the Treasury rate is directly connected to the mortgage rate. Just today, Freddie Mac said the average rate for a 30-year home mortgage fell to its lowest point this year. That's good for home buyers, if they can persuade a bank to give them a loan. Lehman of BDK says it can also be good for existing homeowners.
Refinance your mortgage to a very low rate.
But these low rates are punishing people who save. Savings accounts pay almost nothing now. Lehman says he fields calls from frustrated clients who expected Treasury bonds to carry them through their retirement. As a result, some retirees are moving their money into riskier investments. Here's McGreevy again.
Rather than buying Treasuries at 3%, because that doesn't provide them with enough income for retirement, may go out and buy high-yield bonds.
Tomorrow, the new unemployment numbers will be the next indicator of where interest rates and the economy are headed. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Stocks of for-profit colleges jumped today, the same day the Obama administration announced new rules aimed squarely at the kinds of expensive career training programs that those schools offer. The stock bounce was all about size of relief. In the end, the long-awaited regulations were softer on the industry than many expected. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
For-profit colleges get as much as 90% of their revenue from federal student aid. In other words, the taxpayer. Their students default on their loans at more than twice the rate of students at public colleges. Under the new rules, some for-profit programs may lose access to federal aid if not enough of their students can repay their loans. The goal is to make sure career colleges prepare students for jobs that pay enough to justify the debt they take on. Harris Miller represents for-profit schools at the Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities. He says the new rules amount to price fixing.
What the department has said repeatedly is your students are borrowing too much, and the way to prevent that from happening is you, the school, have to lower your prices.
After intense lobbying by groups like Miller's, the Education Department relaxed its initial version of the rules. Programs will have time to clean up their acts before they're disqualified.
Bottom line, it is disappointing.
Chris Lindstrom directs the higher education program at U.S. Public Interest Research Group. She says the rules don't go far enough to clean up programs that load students with debt and then turn them out into the job market with shaky credentials.
It won't be implemented until 3 years from now. And then when it is, it narrowly defines who the bad actors are, and it gently nudges them towards better behavior.
The rules apply to non-degree programs at public and nonprofit colleges, too. But according to the Education Department, for-profit schools enroll 12% of college students and account for nearly half of loan defaults. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Tornadoes in Massachusetts yesterday added to the chronicle of extreme weather we've been having around the country. Not just the devastating twisters across the lower Midwest. Drought is parching the earth from Arizona right across Texas to Florida. Meanwhile, spring has yet to spring, with wet and cold from the Dakotas and Montana all the way to the Pacific. And it is all wreaking havoc on spring crops. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports from Portland, Oregon.
Brad Rippey's bird's-eye view of America doesn't look too good. He's the U.S. Department of Agriculture's top meteorologist.
Just about anywhere you go in the United States, you can say that weather patterns have been extreme.
All the proof I need is to look out the window every day through pelting rain to the overflowing banks of the Willamette River. Rippey says cold, wet conditions extend across the rich farming region of the Pacific Northwest into Northern California, from wheat fields to cherry orchards.
You don't like to see the fruits ripening on the tree under such a cool, wet regime because you can get droppage or disease problems.
Or worse.
We lost our cherry crop to a frost.
Alan Schreiber farms in eastern Washington. He says pretty much all his crops are behind by several weeks. He's been surveying fields for the State Blueberry Commission.
Well, I have a picture of a blueberry field that has got ducks swimming on it. Every week I'm losing sales, like at farmers markets, because I should have turnips now and I don't. And I should have had strawberries before now, but I don't.
Instead of cherries for the 4th of July, chances are markets will still be full of ripe strawberries, says Bernadine Strick of the Oregon State University Extension Service. But
I think we have to wait and see what happens with price.
Economists say it's too early to tell whether small, late crops will translate to higher bills at the grocery store. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
And returning briefly to market news, the social media coupon giant Groupon filed to become a public company today. The company launched just 3 years ago and has yet to turn a profit. It's hoping to raise $750 million in an initial public offering under the ticker symbol GRPN. Wall Street ended down slightly after a day of volatile trading. We'll have details when we do the numbers. The International Monetary Fund is generating copious headlines today, what with the financial bailouts of Greece, Portugal, and Ireland, and, of course, sexual assault charges against its former chief, Dominique Strauss-Kahn. France is lobbying for its finance minister, Christine Lagarde, to get that job next. But it wasn't too long ago that France, along with many other countries, tagged the IMF as irrelevant. So what has changed? Well, to find out, we turn to former IMF chief economist Simon Johnson, who wrote about this in the economics blog of today's New York Times. Hello.
Nice with you.
Give us a little history here. Wasn't it just a few years ago that France and some of these other countries were calling for the downsizing of the IMF?
Yes, absolutely. As recently as 2007, France and the rest of the G7, the big industrial countries, were calling for big cuts at the IMF, and about 20% of the staff, including some of their best people, were forced out.
So what is the argument now for involving the IMF in Greece's debt crisis?
Well, it's a bit strange, to be honest, because Greece is a member of the European Union and a member of the Eurozone. The euro is one of the strongest currencies in the world. The countries in the Eurozone don't really need the money of the IMF. They have deep fiscal pockets and they have the euro, but turns out they would like to use IMF funding to spread the pain.
So after all this coming together with the European Union, now they don't want the taxpayers of these countries to shoulder the burden?
That's right. Or they'd like the shouldering of the burden to be somewhat more opaque and non-transparent. And that's what happens when the IMF lends. About 30% of the money, the equity and the loans which the IMF can access, comes from Europe. But 70% of it comes from the rest of the world, including 17% from the United States, 7% from Japan, 30-some percent from emerging markets. So really what the Europeans are looking for is a subsidy via the IMF from the taxpayers of all the other member countries in the IMF.
Wait, so that 30% is the Eurozone paying into the IMF and then the IMF paying it back into the Eurozone in Greece?
Yes, there is a completely strange round-tripping angle of this. But also, more broadly, because the euro is a reserve currency, because it's one of the ultimate hard currencies in the world, what the IMF is really doing is raising hard currencies, which call that euros, because dollar becomes euro very easily and quickly, and lending them to the eurozone countries.
How does that affect lending to countries that are outside the EU?
Well, it may have some effect, depending on how the IMF does with regard to its overall resources. If the eurozone situation continues down the path that I would expect, with very big, generous packages being handed to, again, or redone for Greece, Ireland, and Portugal, I think the IMF is going to need to raise more money. In other words, come around and ask the U.S. taxpayer for another contribution. And if they get those other contributions, then their lending to other places that are in trouble, like Egypt or Pakistan or Tunisia, will not be constrained. If the overall amount of resources doesn't change, then it's going to be tight for other countries.
What if the IMF were not involved in bailing out EU member nations? What is the worst-case scenario for the EU at that point?
Well, I think the EU would take care of its own problems. I really don't think they're going to have chaos there. I don't think they're going to panic the markets. There's too much at stake. They would have to face the fiscal costs more directly. The German, French, and other taxpayers would have to be confronted. And, of course, they wouldn't be happy, and they might throw out some politicians, hence the desire of European politicians to somewhat disguise what's actually going on.
So the chances of that happening are?
Look, the French are going to regain control of the IMF. Well, they haven't really lost control. Mr. Strauss-Kahn is out, but Madame Christine Lagarde is almost certainly going to become the next managing director. And they will make sure that the IMF is at the table with some generous money. By the way, and I should stress, this is not a great deal for Greek citizens. They are still going to be very hard-pressed. It's a good deal mostly for the European creditors of Greece.
Simon Johnson, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Coming up, when solar power farms threaten desert tortoises, what's a conservationist to do?
An environmentalist will face a challenge, almost like in a poker game where somebody calls to put down their cards of what really is their priority.
But first, let's do the numbers. After yesterday's drubbing, Wall Street settled down a bit today. The Dow slipped 41 points, a third of a percent, to close at 12,248. The Nasdaq gained 4 points, more than a tenth of a percent, to finish at 2773. And the S&P 500 dipped 1 point, one-tenth percent, to end the day at 1312. We told you earlier about the government's milder-than-expected regulations on for-profit colleges. That news turned market laggards into the day's valedictorians. Apollo Group, which owns the University of Phoenix, saw its shares rise 11%. Another university company, Education Management, soared 22%. We mentioned Groupon, and they gave internet stocks a boost with their much-anticipated filing for a public stock offering. LinkedIn, fresh off its own wildly successful stock market launch, gained 1.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.03%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill, an international producer and marketer of food, agricultural, financial, and industrial products and services. Information at Cargill.com. By Reputation.com, helping small business owners, professionals, and executives monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation.com. And by Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the Knowledge Effect. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. President Obama is in Toledo, Ohio, where he'll talk with workers at a Chrysler plant. A look at the unemployment lines. The Labor Department reports job data for May. And it's about what's really important, beer. A panel discusses the American craft beer revolution at the National Press Club. What would that be like without a beverage in hand? Fortunately, that's scheduled to be part of the conference. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Kai, as we've been noting this week, is on assignment in China. You may remember he and a crew broadcast from Shanghai and Chongqing 5 years ago. A lot has happened since then, both in China and globally. First and foremost, the financial crisis and the Great Recession. So they are back visiting those two cities for an update. Because after all, we are all kind of counting on the Chinese economy to step up and help save the world. So Kai joins us from Shanghai. Hey, Kai.
Hey, Tess.
Or I suppose I should say ni hao.
Ni hao. There you go. That's pretty good.
Thank you very much. So anything interesting happened so far?
Lots interesting. I mean, you can't come to this country and you can't come to Shanghai without interesting things happening. But here's just one. We were out doing some stories on American companies here and Chinese consumers. And we talked to some folks at GM. And we went out to a Chevy dealership, the biggest one in China. And I was talking to the saleswoman there about how she sells to Chinese customers. And so I said, all right, well, listen, give me the sales pitch.
How'd she do?
Well, she did pretty well, actually. I mean, you know, first of all, she's saying it's got good gas mileage and it's good value for your money. And so I decided to throw her a curveball. And I said, listen, I'm sorry, but I have four children and they're just not going to fit in this car. And two things happened. One was you could see a look come across her face because nobody's ever going to walk into a Chinese car dealership and say, I've got four children because of the one child policy.
Yeah.
But the other thing she said was, well, sir, then I think you ought to buy two. So you give her points for thinking on her feet, right? But it's also a little insight as to why GM is doing as well as it's doing here, which is, by the way, really, really well.
Well, let's talk about GM for a minute, since they might be one of the biggest American success stories there, aren't they?
Yeah, they are absolutely one of the biggest American success stories. And I'll give you an example. The Buick. You see them all over the place over here. They are a status symbol for a certain section of the market. There's a part of the Chinese car buying public that buys cars not to drive them, but to be driven around in. And so what GM said was, listen, we need to make a car with a longer wheelbase that gives more room in the back end for the person who's being chauffeured around. Right?
Huh.
So they kind of figured out that little thing. But I was having a conversation with the head of GM China the other day, and I asked him about the company's growth because it has been unbelievable. They went from 500,000 cars a year 5 years ago when Marketplace was here to 2.3 million cars every single year. I mean, that's like the definition of explosive growth. And I said, how do you plan for that? And he said, oh, I just plan to stay a full factory ahead.
Gee.
So this guy is selling more cars in China than GM North America. He's making billions of dollars. And what he's doing is he's planning by the factory full his expansion, which is kind of amazing.
Boy, that just says it right there.
Yeah.
So good for GM. Also seems like it's good for the U.S., the world even. You know, we've got the global downturn, industrialized nations growing at 3-4% at best. China's still going great guns at, what, 7-8%?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So are you getting the sense that Chinese people are ready to step up and help drive the rest of the global economy? Are they ready to spend?
Yeah, so here's the thing. So when we came here last time, the basic question we were asking was, should Americans be afraid of China and its growing economic power? And our reporting at that time basically led us to the conclusion of no, because there are so many other things going on here. And that's exactly the same now. I think in a roundabout way of answering your question, they just have their hands full over here. I mean, yes, there are some problems in the American-Chinese relationship, right? They control our debt. We've got a trade gap, all of that stuff. But I think if you go out on the street outside my hotel and you ask the average person, they are way more worried about inflation at 5%, what food is going to cost next month, than they are about what their purchasing power means for American GDP. And I'll give you one more example on the possibility of a downside risk here. We did some interviews yesterday about real estate in Shanghai, which is unbelievably high. And we talked to this 24-year-old guy who owns his own apartment. He just bought another one last month at the top of the market. And so I said to him, aren't you worried that this is all going to come crashing down? And he looked at me and he said, no, Shanghai real estate will never lose money. And so I tried to explain to him the whole American real estate crash thing. And he looked at me and he said, Shanghai real estate is different. So we agreed to disagree, I guess.
All right. Kai Rizdahl joining us from his hotel room in Shanghai. Hey, do me a favor, would you? Teach me how to say goodbye.
Zaijian.
Zaijian.
Zai Jian. Literally, I will see you again. Zai, again, see you. Jian.
All right. Auf Wiedersehen.
See you later.
And for more of Kai's trip, do check out his blog at marketplace.org. If you're worried about whether you'll get Social Security benefits when you retire, well, you may consider looking for a job in China. Starting next month, China will extend its Social Security benefits to the more than 500,000 foreigners who work there. Of course, that means foreigners will have to pay a new tax. Our China correspondent, Rob Schmitz, is also in Shanghai, and he sent this report.
So here's the deal. In return for $100 a month, you, foreign executive working in China, get access to Chinese retirement benefits. That'll include cheap prices at your local Chinese public hospital, a place where no matter how dire your condition is, you'll have to take a number and stand in line all day in a healthcare system that could make you wish you were at a hospital back in the States. Sean Ryan is the managing director of China Market Research, a market intelligence firm based in Shanghai. He says most foreigners in China aren't thrilled with the deal.
The benefits that you get from the medical coverage is really not very good. Given a choice, most employees would rather have private health care insurance. It's cheaper and they get better coverage.
The new tax will make it more costly to hire foreigners in China. Ryan says China's doing this in part to make foreign companies hire more Chinese employees. But China also needs money for a multi-billion-dollar program to overhaul its healthcare system. James McGregor, an author and a consultant in Beijing, says collecting a tax from foreigners that'll never benefit foreigners will help.
This will be just one more thing that is making China a more difficult place to do business. It's just par for the course. China's got the power, they got the market, and they're kind of doing these things because they can.
Whether they will is another question. Residents from Taiwan, Macau, and Hong Kong have been subject to such taxes for years, but the government hasn't put much effort into collecting them. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmidt for Marketplace.
By some estimates, we will need to devote land the size of Australia to renewable energy to keep air pollution levels in check. Finding that land is one obstacle, and being able to use it, if you find it, is another. The debate over land use for green energy is creating some surprising disagreements. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill reports.
Pity the man who washes cars on the Hawaiian island of Lanai. Deep red mud is everywhere. We roll up the windows of our Jeep before the biggest puddles to keep the grit out of our mouths. John Stubbert is the director of utilities for Castle & Cook, a real estate company owned by David Murdoch, which owns most of this island. He manages not to get us stuck on our drive out to a remote part of Lanai.
It's not barren, but it's not populated at all. There's scrub brush growing and grasses.
And most importantly,
it's windy.
The wind whips my hair across my face.
It is one of the prime areas in the world for a wind farm.
Castle & Cook wants to build a wind farm that could cover as much as a quarter of Lanai, more than 20,000 acres. The spinning turbines would be three or four times as tall as the nearby pine trees. The energy would travel via undersea cable to Oahu, where tourists in Waikiki need electricity for dancing at pool parties and blending their pineapple mixed drinks. The wind farm proposal would help Hawaii reach its goal of 40% locally generated renewable energy by 2030. But some on Lanai hate the idea. They don't want the natural area disturbed. It's a land use debate that's becoming more and more common, pitting one type of environmentalist, conservationists, against another type of environmentalist, those who think our first priority should be getting off fossil fuels ASAP.
It is certainly possible that as we scale up wind power and solar power, that more and more of the U.S. will have this infrastructure. And it is certainly possible that this tension and trade-offs will become an even bigger issue.
Matt Kahn is an environmental economist from UCLA. He thinks there are ways to go about making these decisions better, and he has the types of ideas you might expect from an economist, like putting dollar values on nature. It's easier to compare the value of a rare plant to the value of a megawatt of clean energy when you have dollar figures for both. But Kahn says at some level, this is a philosophical debate.
And environmentalists will face a challenge, almost like in a poker game where somebody calls to put down their cards of what really is their priority.
Endangered animals or clean energy? Go. Bet. Now. What'd you choose? You don't have to tell. And Bill Corcoran from the Sierra Club says not to worry. It's a choice that we probably won't have to make that often.
There's plenty of available land that won't disturb the important wildlife and plants that have had conflicts with some existing projects.
Corcoran works on renewable energy for the Sierra Club, an organization that fought against a solar farm in the California desert that would disrupt land used by desert tortoises. But he says with better foresight, it's a conflict that might have been avoided.
Any human endeavor involves trade-offs, but I don't think the ones here are a steep cliff to climb.
Corcoran says this is much more about the need for better planning, better policy, and better information about where the sun shines and tortoises don't live. He thinks when information catches up with demand, there will be far fewer disagreements over which land to use for wind turbines and solar arrays and which land to leave be. It's information that could help people figure out when it makes sense to dedicate big chunks of land, like red, remote Lanai, to wind turbines. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
And you can find a video of Lanai at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, offering retirement and 401k plans to businesses for more than 60 years. MassMutual.com/retirestrong. By The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world and the connections between them on newsstands, Android smartphones, and at The Economist Online. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, the New York Times today named Jill Abramson as its new executive editor. She replaces Bill Keller, who will be writing for the magazine and the op-ed page. Abramson's appointment comes as the Times, like so many newspapers, is struggling to find new sources of revenue. Abramson started at the Times as an investigative journalist in 1997 after moving over from the Wall Street Journal. A little personal insight here. She told New York Magazine that she has a tattoo of a subway token on her right shoulder. And by the way, Abramson is also the first woman to take the helm as executive editor. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow slipped 41 points, a 3%. The Nasdaq gained 4 points, more than a tenth. And the S&P 500 dipped 1.1%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, comedian Albert Brooks's version of America's future, including a youth-led rebellion against the olds.
Because the people who are currently getting the Medicare are the voters. Those people have nothing to do, so they show up at the polls.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.